smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Andrew Freeman. Andrew Freeman is the John R. Coleman Associate Professor of History at Haverford College. He's also the author of Covert Capital, Landscapes of Denial and the Making of U.S. Empire in the Suburbs of Northern Virginia. How are you doing this morning, Andrew?
I'm great, Ethelbert. It's good to see you.
Okay, well, a lot for us to discuss this morning. I want to begin with the title of your book. When one uses the term U.S. Empire, what does that mean? And does the U.S. empire differ from other historical empires?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you know, I think one thing that's really important to think about with U.S. empire and colonialism is that it stretches back to the period of other empires and colonial systems. You know, if you think about empire as a system of expropriation, occupation, violence, some spatial scope, expansionist racial nationalism, that from a very early period, the settler colonial project within the United States is an imperial project. And the United States is built through empire and colonial occupation from 1848 and the taking of Mexican land up through 1898 and the colonization of the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Guam and elsewhere, up into the occupations in the Caribbean in the 1920s, really then through World War II, and maybe when people conventionally think of contemporary U.S. imperialism as the U.S. spreads out into the world under the sort of alibi of the superpowers, the kind of imperial rune for U.S. imperialism. And so I think the first thing is just to think about how the U.S. is right on time with other colonial powers in a way that's not as exceptionalist as the United States would maybe make itself out to be. I think the thing that's perhaps different is, you know, people for a long time were sort of reluctant to talk about the United States as an imperial power. And, you know, back to Jefferson, he was calling the U.S. an empire of liberty or empire for liberty. I think that seeming paradox is something that kind of haunts all the way through U.S. imperial operations down to the Cold War period and then the War on Terror period. So, that's my sort of initial definition of empire, but I'm happy to talk more about it.
Well, you know, when you say that, the U.S. president that I think about, who doesn't get mentioned a lot, is James K. Polk and Manifest Destiny. You know, I mean, that's when I think like, okay, we have a reason for doing all of this. Where does he fit in terms of your analysis?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think of some of that stuff. I mean, it's interesting to think of that phrase as like a kind of early newspaper hype phrase, you know, sort of like the early like social media craze phrase. But in that sort of, you know, picking up from the Monroe Doctrine kind of era of the U.S. thinking and articulating like a police power for the world. But I think that sometimes phrases like that are like almost kind of ways of making sacred pretty base and, you know, unalloyed forms of violence and occupation and counterinsurgency. You know, when you say it as Manifest Destiny.
Or then the other president I would bring into the discussion is Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
It seems like he's another person, a guy on a horse.
Yeah, I mean, but he was also like a big ailing nerd, you know, and sort of remade his image as a sort of masculinist hero riding of hills in Puerto Rico. And so I think in Cuba. And so, Yeah, I mean, those guys articulated something important. I mean, I think for the period of the 20th century and post-World War II period that I write about in the book, you know, what's interesting is how those are family legacies they carry forward in the United States. Like when Kim Roosevelt runs the coup in Iran in 53, he's crossing the border remembering, you know, and thinking about his relative, Teddy Roosevelt, and his own brave, you know, African safari crossings. You know, they would say that, you know, the children and grandchildren of missionaries became the CIA officers in Asia.
Okay, well, we'll get into that a little later in our discussion. Yeah. I like how you said these guys. Okay.
But it's like they're fighting family stories as much as they're upholding some sacred principle of U.S. expansion, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's the general point there.
Okay. You mentioned in the introduction of Covert Capital that the suburbs of Northern Virginia once formed part of the nation's capital. What happened in 1846?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's huge. You know, I feel like today people don't think about that enough, that, you know, there's this national project in Maryland and Virginia donating land to the capital. It's already a compromise to locate the capital in the South, you know, in the first place. And in a kind of racialized, racist protest leading up to the Civil War, Virginia kind of steals its land back. You know, there are a lot of reasons for that. Sometimes people talk about how Alexandria and the Northern Virginia half didn't feel like it was being developed as quickly as the DC Maryland half, but like none of the capital was being developed at that rapid rate at that point. The major thing that was going on is Southerners are trying to protect Alexandria's slave trade port. And immediately after they take their capital back, they close all their schools for free Black children. And Virginia gets a larger congressional representation for the enslaver states. So born in that moment of racial violence, I think about in the book, like what happens to a land like that, that's kind of ethically broken along the lines of race and racial violence, and what happens there to something that was supposed to be part of our capital, but then was stolen back.
Mm-hmm. You in your book, you write about what is called the Dulles Corridor. For people who might be stuck in traffic right now, talk about about this corridor that began to develop in 1941, and also in terms of the National Airport, the Pentagon 43. But then also talk about the following people: Allen Dulles, John Foster Dulles, and Eleanor Dulles.
Yeah, so, you know, basically post-World War II, U.S. imperialism picks up with the triumvirate between John Foster Dulles as Secretary of State, Allen Dulles as head of the CIA, and Eisenhower as president. The Dulles Corridor is essentially named for the family, ostensibly because the airport in 62, Dulles Airport, is named for John Foster Dulles, so that's why they call it the Dulles Corridor. But what I argue in the book is that actually you could think of this deeper register for why the Dulles Corridor is the name for this stretched out imperial space, right? Like the Pentagon opens in 43, CIA headquarters, they start kind of planning for it in the 50s, and it finally opens in 61. It expands the GW Parkway up, which really builds that part of the landscape. And then National Airport, now Reagan National, but I still call it National, opening in the 40s, and basically all together they form a corridor that's about 25 miles long and 8 miles wide. And the reason that I bring Eleanor Dulles into this conversation is part of the reason, I would say a major reason, Allen Dulles wants to move to that landscape at a time when people all over the metro area are offering the CIA headquarters land. But he's obsessed from the beginning with this one part of upper Fairfax County near McLean. And the reason for that, I would say, is the fact that his sister builds in the 50s, this like gleaming modernist house near this swimming pool where the Dulleses are sort of using this domestic and casual space to make foreign policy in a major way, putting foreign leaders in bathing suits, giving them tubs of rye whiskey, casually sort of alluring them to this expansive, open field that's known at that point as the suburbs. And Dulles likes it there. There's a social comfort there for the family going back to the 20s. And together, they really make something new there, including and the Eisenhower piece is there, too, from when Eisenhower is visiting his brother, Milton, while Milton Eisenhower is planning Japanese internment at his house, which is very close to theirs, also in Fairfax County. So there's all kinds of ways they root into the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have Andrew Freeman, you have an interesting way of looking at Northern Virginia. And I want you to talk about your early research, because it seems to me that you must have been first looking at U.S. foreign policy and how it shapes the world, and then you came back to Virginia.
Well, I mean, I think actually the project emerged simultaneously. A thing that always interested me a lot, I don't know if you've ever driven down 123.
I don't know how to drive, Andrew.
Yeah. I've ridden down 123, okay. Dolly Madison Boulevard, but... A major thing that you find is you're passing the CIA headquarters at Langley, and what it looks like is a beautiful park filled with trees. All you see is trees. You don't see this massive modernist headquarters building, and that always interested me. Like, what did it mean that this entity that, you know, if you were in Chile or you were in Vietnam or you were in Iran, people are haunted by this major...
Well, no, let me interrupt you. Let me interrupt you, Andrew Freeman. So what happened? You see the building, but in the back of your mind, you got these James Bond movies.
Yeah.
Right? And so what happened? You know, the high day of spies and people like that, you know, they have drinks, you know, they hang out, you know, and maybe now and then they kill somebody, you know. But, so I'm just pushing back, because that has a lot to do with what we get through movies, films, and things of that sort. So when you say you drive by, I'm saying, okay, when you look out the car window, you see this. But then what is also in your mind that you connect what you see with ideas that you've been coming through, like social media?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other piece of that is just thinking, I mean, I grew up in Northern Virginia, so I had a different feeling about it. But I think thinking about how a place that's constituted as like a nice, quote unquote, normal, quote unquote, desirable, wealthy American suburb is not other to American imperialism, but defined by it. You know, how do we connect? How do we connect these places together?
Okay, now before we connect these places, you said something that I'm gonna mess with you. Okay, you said, see, you grew up in this area.
Yeah.
So you probably said, Andrew Freeman, you had an unhappy childhood. You wanted to get out. Were you bullied or ever? Did somebody take your lunch?
I mean, well, I don't live there now.
So I know. You got away.
but I was interested in how the everyday life of that place was like the absent presence around something else.
Right. Well, let's talk about something very on a serious note, because it's key to your work, Andrew Freeman. What can one learn from studying landscapes, and how is a community built?
Yeah, I mean, well, I really think of landscapes as an archive. You and I have talked about archives a bit before, and like, I think that watching and witnessing how places fit together, what place names are like, how things are designed, is archival. And the challenge is to be able to read and study that archive and figure out what it's telling us. I mean, one thing that happened in the book, another driving or riding story was driving by Saigon Road off Georgetown Pike, which I'd driven past millions of times and not even thought about it because we're just used to so many names being kind of forgotten traces of something people don't care about. But then once I started thinking in this way, I was like, why is there Saigon Road in the middle of the Virginia suburbs? And, you know, I think asking questions about the things you pass every day and animating them as archival possibilities for really far distant transnational imperial power relationships that seem invisible but are actually quite present as we're moving around cities and suburbs all the time.
You know, when you say that, Andrew, it seems like it's a direct link to what we've seen the last few years, and that's the battle against monuments, Confederate monuments, because it seems that these things actually were a way of marking the landscape.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think one thing we could also think about is, like, where are all the monuments to the things that the U.S. spent most of its time doing in the second half of the 20th century? You know, where are the monuments in the United States to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Vietnam, or the coup in Iran, or to all the migrants who came to the United States from places that the U.S. had made promises to and incurred debts to? And then, you know, were often treated as sort of new immigrants who had to adjust to a new society, rather than intimates and friends who were in American spheres and places at home and knew more about America in some ways than their new neighbors when they got here. Where are those monuments, and how do we think about how to repair the debts of empire? I think it's a profound question that obviously doesn't come into the heroic monument tradition as it's fought over, negative or positive, in the present, but I think are really living questions.
Talk about the term covert capital, because, you know, you just made reference to, like, you know, Vietnam and Iraq. But we know that key developments in our world, it takes place after World War II and the Cold War. Talk about the 1950s and exactly how this is shaping this corridor.
Yeah, I mean, so the key thing with the phrase covert capital is, like, that we have an overt capital in Washington, D.C., the symbolic capital. But then basically, from the 40s forward, the sort of military, industrial, and covert state builds its own capital for specific reasons in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. And I think there are all kinds of reasons for that. You know, I mean, the Department of War had just gotten a brand new building that they have decided to abandon in the booming government economies of World War II to move to the Pentagon. The CIA was spread out in a million, not literally, but in a lot of shabby, leaking, stinking tempos on the Washington Mall. And there's this time where they're, like, kind of breaking the presumptions of democratic accountability and a sort of balance of power and axial relationships with other branches of government as they move out to Northern Virginia. And I think thinking that there are democratic implications to that is profound and important. I mean, I also think there are literal things they get out of that. Like, you know, there's a sense out in Northern Virginia at that point of, like, building worlds anew. And I think that's, like, a deep lived metaphor for the ways that imperial agents are thinking that they can remake the world in that period. You know, there's a thing about being isolated. There's a thing about moving to a Jim Crow and Confederate landscape where white suburbanization is displacing free Black communities that had been there since the sort of first freed period. So there's all kinds of things that that offers. I mean, one of the most spectacular pieces of the Eleanor Dulles House is that it's built in all glass. There are a fair amount of modernist houses out in Northern Virginia at this period, but I really think there was a feeling people had there. There was, like, a view onto a developable landscape. You know, there's a feeling that boundaries and rules are dissolving. You know, there's a thing about being out on the cusp of you know, civilization. And I think all those sort of affective or emotional charges are a part of US imperial activity and the covert capital. I mean, that's another thing, just thinking about the endeavors they're doing abroad, which I don't think a lot of foreign policy historians really talk about, is like, they were having fun. You know, like, even if in practice they were doing something really violent that was like ending democratic horizons in nations all over the world, they were like, I mean, thinking about these guys, back to that phrase, you know, they were like a crew, you know, they were having fun. They were doing their thing, both out in Northern Virginia and around the world. I think thinking of that aspect of it is important. And looking at how they build and settle Northern Virginia really emphasizes the parties they're going to, the friendships they're making, the backslapping.
Right. Well, you in your comments today, you made a few references to the role that race plays in the development of Northern Virginia. What was Northern Virginia like before, during, and after the Civil War?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that there is a complex sort of plantation geography in Northern Virginia, stretching some ways back. I think thinking about the fundamental role that Alexandria's enslavers, traders, are playing in the entire Circum-Caribbean and transatlantic slave trade is really crucial for thinking about that landscape. And as we're moving towards the Civil War, I think thinking about free Black communities in Northern Virginia and the impact of both coming into the capital space and leaving the capital space are all extremely important in that period. Obviously, as the Civil War starts, and the Union is fighting and occupying the landscape, the first freed are self-emancipating and coming to Northern Virginia to build communities, to settle in the realm of the capital as the radical Reconstruction Republican government is like abolishing slavery earlier than the rest of the country and passing all these civil rights laws. So you get a kind of Black world and a Black tradition of activism in Arlington and Alexandria that is major going forward. I mean, from the early period, that like one of the early NAACP chapters, you know, like the like sit-in at the Alexandria Library, which is a huge deal, like one of the first sit-ins in the country. Many Virginians challenging the laws that make you switch seats when buses and trains cross the border. You know, so there's this huge activist tradition in free Black Northern Virginia that's defining the landscape. And I think, you know, but then there's also this sort of resistant Jim Crow tradition. Segregation lasts longer than there. You know, massive resistance is fighting school desegregation. Like the poll tax lasts longer in Virginia than in a lot of places. You know, the laws against interracial marriage last longer in Virginia than a lot of places. So all that stuff is combining. And I think the broken up governing structure in Northern Virginia, counties and towns, makes it really uneven depending on where you are in terms of how people are experiencing that. So I think that when the CIA and the Pentagon, to an extent, move out there, they're building on that racial system, but they're also displacing a lot of Black landowners and also just flooding Northern Virginia with new white migrants working for the federal government. 11,000 people work at the CIA in its early days when it's not even really acknowledged on county planning maps. So they're really building a new space together that I think of as an imperial space, similar to the places they were building abroad. And then one thing that comes out of that is, as imperial communities are being formed through those relationships, migrants from all over the world are coming back to Northern Virginia because their sponsors and their friends and their colleagues and their intimates already live there. And so you get what might be an irony, or might be a founding part of U.S. empire down to the present, where now people think of Northern Virginia as one of the most diverse parts of the metropolitan D.C. world. For a long time, and maybe even still, Southerners call Northern Virginia occupied Virginia, you know? So I think there's a real complexity now, but definitely when people are looking at the diversity and quote unquote multiculturalism of Northern Virginia in the present, that's an imperial trace. It's not just, you know, a part of the halcyon horizon that the suburbs offer. And then, I mean, I think thinking about Northern Virginia is also in an ongoing kind of imperial relationship with DC. It's also like why DC never got a commuter tax. How could we think of that as similar to the imperial and colonial governing arrangements all over the world and related to DC's own status?
Okay, I'm going to ask you one more question before we take our break, Andrew Freeman. You mentioned in your book that two Nike missile stations were erected in the 1950s to protect DC in case of nuclear attack. This brought me back to the duck and cover when I was growing up in New York.
Yeah, the turtle.
How did you learn about that? And how is the corridor protected today?
I mean, all that stuff is in federal archives, you know, and many people have written about it. They're Nike stations in a ring, you know, they're like the sort of Cold War version of the Civil War forts that are ringing DC that then later get.
Sounds like you're talking about the dome around Tel Aviv.
Yeah, right. The Nike stations are kind of similar to that. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting, if you're thinking about landscape as archive, is what floods in different points, right? Like in 61, in the 40s, you get the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. In 61, you get the Langley headquarters. As like new sort of, as Reagan's resurgence of U.S. imperialism and aggression around the world in the 80s comes in, the corridor is convulsed again by a new CIA headquarters attached to the old one at Langley, and all these new skylines, basically, that people start to notice. And then as time goes by, now we get Liberty Crossing and the National Counterterrorism Center and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the Geospatial
Agency. But you know what? The reason why I got into this, Andrew Freeman, is because whenever there's some sort of incident around the White House, you know, like somebody flies a plane nearby, we see this sort of response. But then I said, okay, how come, based on what you're saying in your book, how come there was never any response in terms of preventing a plane from crashing into the Pentagon after 9/11, if there's this sort of protection around the area?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm sure somebody was probably mad about that, right? I mean, sometimes we might ask, like, what is the security state and covert state focusing on, if not protecting people in the United States? And I mean, you might actually think that an attention to distributing violence around the world maybe is more important to some actors than protecting a broad, diverse group of people within the U.S. context. But
yeah, because I, you know, when I think about your research and getting back to this concept of landscape, we know, for example, we look at Washington, D.C., especially down by the mall and the key building, the landscape changed with the barriers and things of that sort.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why we didn't see that taking place also, say, in Northern Virginia.
I mean, one thing that I think is really important about Northern Virginia is the landscape itself is the barrier.
Okay.
You know, the ways that highways and like trees and one-way streets and you know, weird kind of mountain passes and hard to navigate landscapes that are already jagged and
okay, I'm going to stop you right there. We go to our commercial, but you sound like you're talking about, yes, and we have this protection in down in New Orleans, and so we don't have to deal with Hurricane Katrina. Joking. Right, just right. My guest today is Andrew Freeman. Andrew Freeman is the John R. Coleman Associate Professor of History at Haverford College. And we've been talking about his new book, Covert Capital, Landscape of Denial and the Making of U.S. Empire in the Suburbs of Northern Virginia. The show's On the Margin. My name is Elizabeth Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar. For two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Andrew Freeman. Andrew, let's talk a little bit more about the CIA. You write in your book that you tend to return to it like a tonic. Okay, how does the CIA change American culture?
Well, what the CIA promises at the time is really two forms of efficiency. There's the idea of efficiency as like the orderly processing of information, the sort of organization man, the idea that data and knowledge in that way can streamline things and make them flow in unobstructed ways, expertise. Then there's this other idea of efficiency that's more connected to new foreign policy, which is like the CIA is promising that instead of big, clunky, heavy wars like World War II and World War I, the CIA promises an efficiency where the U.S. can pinpoint and go into places and manage world affairs through things like coups and police actions and assassinations. And
this is all before the development of drones.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that. And then that carries forward into the fantasy of the drone as like a pinpoint nonviolent form of imperial and global management. You know, the idea that like a guy sitting in a bunker in Northern Virginia near a strip mall can just surgically execute a foreign policy without, you know, a lot of drafted soldiers and a lot of harm spread within the U.S. And, you know, quickly we see that both of those forms of efficiency are fantastic as in fantasies, in the fact that, you know, there's a huge amount of blood and destruction caused by them. But the idea of that, you know, and that's connected to what you're saying about, you know, the James Bond idea of the spy, you know, that he is smarter than everybody else and just kind of outwits other people. And I think that itself was a kind of CIA propaganda for its own work, you know, that idea of what spies do. But yeah, I think that that's one major way that the CIA spread an obsession for a certain kind of liberated action into American culture, at the same time that I think it broke other presumptions of density and intensity of democratic contact and debate and openness and legibility that could also be thought to be part of a functioning democratic country, you know. And so I think the sort of secrets and open secrets and sort of deception and, you know, counterintelligence and propaganda that now is such a huge part of our national life, I think, emanates from this sort of efficiency, pseudo-efficient moment.
Right. But you write in, you also write in your book that Northern Virginia was a CIA safe house. Explain what you meant by that.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's really important that basically the CIA is the United States' answer to decolonization. They're the kind of civil service of the U.S. colonial empire. And I think that thinking about a safe house where you can go back and restore yourself, where there are people to take care of you, where you can hide out, where you know no one will find you. Like, there are certain aspects of the early undeveloped Northern Virginia suburbs that continue on today that I think make those places a redoubt for CIA officers and other U.S. imperial agents of all sorts, you know, and military figures. And I think that it's, you know, just going back to the idea of what the suburbs are. I mean, a lot of times people talk about the suburbs as like a set of mortgages and highway laws and white flight and that kind of narrative of the suburbs. But I think the suburbs also provided a certain kind of cover, right? that people were just running from cities and resettling, you know, in places where they wanted land and community and lawns and middle-class life. But I think thinking about the way some of the trappings of suburbs also provided covers and safe houses for complex forms of transnational imperial work is a huge deal.
You know, as I was reading your book, Andrew Freeman, I was wondering to what extent does the FBI building located in downtown D.C. influence the city's identity, the same way you're talking about, you know, what's going on in Northern Virginia. You know, you go downtown and here is the FBI building. Okay. So I was wondering, you know, and it's very interesting. Sometimes you see people coming out the side to go for lunch and stuff, but you know, I've never been inside for the little small tours they give you, but you know, how does, based on your analysis in terms of Northern Virginia now, and I guess it's moving into your new research, how does the FBI building, you know, affect the identity of DC?
Well, I mean, one thing to think about with those buildings, I mean, so it's the brutalist concrete era, right? Like Key Bridge Marriott, the FBI building, like that whole looming skyline and era of that period. I mean, one thing about those buildings is just like thinking about urban renewal in Southwest, the ways that they were almost like, they're almost like barricades, you know, like where you don't feel like you can move across the center of Washington because of all these massive looming concrete buildings. And so I do think that there's a way that just spatially and structurally, they're like the Berlin Wall or something, dividing parts of the city from each other in fundamental ways. But I mean, most practically, as you know, like a big way the FBI building affected DC is not only as a symbol, but as the site of FBI agents who are fanning out into the city to stalk and harass like Black and other radical activists of color throughout the entirety of the 60s and 70s, you know, and thinking about the ways that level of repression emanating from that building affected and transformed radical movements in Washington, I think is another major thing that we want to think about. If you think about DC as a colony as well, in terms of its government status, having both local and national and international institutions of repression to contend with in the city is certainly a unique.
Well, you know what I was looking at, based on your own research, Andrew Freeman, is that when you're talking about Northern Virginia, you're talking about how people work and live there. Okay. When I look at the FBI building, it seems like some of the people, like they go to Virginia, you know what I mean? They come in, but you know, I'm just wondering like, okay, I work at the FBI building, you know, for the NLCS and I live in Petworth and Alice Morgan. And, you know, I just, you know, it's just based on your research of how this community develops in Northern Virginia. I don't see that the FBI building having that thing where everybody's living around the FBI building in D.C.
Yeah, I don't think that's true, but I do think that you can. No, I mean, I don't think they are, but I do think that you can think about how all the highway fights in Washington and all the fights around, like I was saying before, the commuter tax are actually related to people from Northern Virginia wanting access to certain kinds of resources in Washington and yet wanting to break some forms of intimacy and residency with Washingtonians. And like, I think that's the structure that's informing some of the ways that those downtown buildings are so alien to local communities. I mean, another thing, obviously, that the FBI is doing is fighting the Cold War across Northern Virginia and Maryland parks and dead drops, you know, when they're meeting covert agents and double agents in the U.S. state. They're sending counterintelligence agencies throughout the landscape to...
Come on, Andrew, now you're saying that somebody's dropping something off at behind a tree in Rock Creek Park.
No, I mean, they definitely literally did that.
I'm going to leave it. We're going to go from Rock Creek Park to Dumbarton Oaks. Okay. You are a Mellon Fellow in Democracy and Landscape Studies at Dumbarton Oaks, Harvard University. Your new work is Capital Colony, Decolonization in the District of Columbia. Talk about this work that you're doing right now and the link between, you know, covert capital and this new book that you're working on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So, I mean, I always like the idea that an academic book or a scholarly book could have a sequel, like a B-movie or something. And so Capital Colony is like my sequel.
So what is it going to be, like Rocky V or something like that?
I'll have like a 10th one. They'll all have alliteration down the road. I'll just keep writing these sequels. But, you know, as I was writing Covert Capital and giving talks about it, a lot of people are like, well, then what's D.C.? You know, like what happens in D.C. that people know of as the capital if the capital moves in some sense to Northern Virginia in this period? And I really started thinking a lot about the different intersecting ways that D.C. is a colonial space in this period. You know, obviously it's a settler colony from the beginning on Nacotchtank and Piscataway land. Then it's a metropole, like an imperial metropole that people from throughout the U.S. colonial empire are returning to. But it's also itself a colonized space because of the anomalous governing status that Washington has granted in the Constitution. So I was really interested in thinking how that colonial legacy that really in a lot of ways provides a template for U.S. empire and colonialism
When you say that, Andrew, you sound like the type of person, like scholar, someone would bring into a hearing where we're discussing statehood.
I mean, definitely a lot of the statehood hearing discourse is about this. You know, the Black United Front and the statehood party were constantly bringing this anti-colonial vision to any debate around home rule or statehood throughout that whole period. And I think there are a lot of ways that, you know, we know statehood as the idea of becoming a state, but the idea of statehood was also fundamentally influenced by all these anti-colonial movements around the world that were becoming states, you know, not U.S. states, but independence Africa and Asia.
Right. We'll talk about something which you mentioned, I think, before we went on the air. You're here doing research, and you were looking at the Hilda Mason papers. Talk about what's the and the size of the Hilda Mason papers.
Yeah, so yesterday, actually... as my friends at the DC Public Library have been helping me so much, you know, I finished looking at the 405 boxes of the Hilda Mason papers. I also spent a large amount of time in the Ethelbert Miller papers.
I want to ask you about that.
a great collection of a wonderful poet at GW. And, you know, a lot of what's, I think, powerful about those archives and the many others in Washington is that they're snapshots of an entire time in DC when anti-colonial movements around the world, including Latin America and the Caribbean, are sending people to Washington to, you know, induce forms of national representation. They're coming as students, they're coming as writers, they're coming as intellectuals, but they're completely absorbed in this independence moment and decolonization, global sort of revolution. And they're meeting and intersecting with Washingtonians who are also thinking about radical forms of independence, home rule, and cultural emancipation, both in architecture and space, in writing and literature and music and art, and in like more explicitly politically organized ways. And so the book is really about those intersections. Mm-hmm. And something that I think is incredible about the Hilda Mason papers is, like, I mean, much like yourself, she kept everything. Like, that idea of that archival imagination, where things that are passing through your fingers, flyers, letters, notes, emails, that you don't want to let go, and that they might mean something.
Well, let me ask you this question. This is helping me, because many times journalists are using my archive, but you're a scholar. What attracted you to my archives, and then how do you? I'm just passing this thing on. How do you navigate it? You know, what did you find that was helpful to your research?
Yeah, I mean, so that's a difference with, I mean, your archive has an incredible finding aid, which makes it navigable, right? So you can look through the finding aid for people you're interested in, or organizations you're interested in, places you're interested in. The Mason archive is unprocessed, had none of that. So basically, I looked through every box and every folder and just kind of intuited what I needed. And
you said it was like about 450 boxes or something.
405, yeah. I know as of yesterday. And I think that, like, being open to archives teaching you something is also important. You know, definitely. I mean, I worked on archives in an interesting way in Covert Capital, because archives, and often really mundane archives, were some of the only places that covert agents had to meet the overt state, right? So while people's work abroad is shrouded in secrecy and you're mostly learning about it through exposés or declassified documents, everybody has to file building permits if they make adjustments to their houses. Everybody's, like, place where they live is in the zoning archive. Everybody's in the phone book at that period. The phone book is one of my favorite sources ever.
Like an old Rolodex or something.
Yeah, and read phone books and Rolodexes and business cards. You know, but I think that you also sometimes have to be taught. And definitely when I was reading yours, Mason papers, it's like, there are so many things that you just don't even know about until you see them, or you're holding a flyer from them and you're like, oh my God, this is how it fits together. And a lot of how I move is through, like, characters and protagonists and how they relate and where they went and what they were into. And I think once you're looking at things like that, this whole narrative world opens up of sort of poetic associations that, in the case of this book, are revealing something important about decolonization in DC and all these movements that were intersecting, Puerto Rican revolutionaries.
But you mentioned something in your remark, Andrew Freeman, which I think should really be underscored. You talk about how when you're using Hilda Mason's papers, they're not really, like, you know, catalog and things of that sort. And that's what I think about many historically Black colleges, many, you know, places where the funding is just not there, or the staff is not there. You know, somebody deposits something, but, you know, you can't access it. And I also see this as a need for maybe many people to go into the field of library science, you know. Or for example, I remember there were very few African-American archivists, you know. And so you can see that when the research that you're doing, I mean, you show up, there has to be this partnership between, you know, to make your research easier. Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, the folks at the People's Archive working hard to process the Mason papers in different ways over the years. You know, they're all working on that stuff all the time. But I do think that, like, traditions of Black archiving and, you know, for people to think about the power of that work and making our history legible in that way is profound. I mean, that's something I really admire with the work that you're doing. It's like, what are the theories and practices of Black archiving and intimacy that are entering into the archives we're creating? And I mean, your thing about, like, a lot of people, if they talk to some student or some writer coming up in the game for the first time, would just be like, I don't, you know, I'll answer or not, but I don't really care about this person. But the idea of, like, oh no, these contacts are sacred, and, you know, they're part of, like, our intimate moving forward.
You know, it's funny that you said that, because just a few days ago, the writer, and I love him, the writer A. Van Jordan, was visiting, you know, when we had breakfast together. And I said, you know, we talked about his writing. And I said, you know, I have a copy of your manuscript. You know?
Yeah.
And what happened, it had the whole thing, like, me giving, analyzing his poems and crossing things out. And, you know, and when you get a copy of the actual first book, Rise, that he did, if you go back and look at what's in my archives, you can see how he made, he revised his work and stuff like that. You don't get that sometimes now in terms of writers, just, you know, unless you're saving, you know, the electronic correspondence, you don't really have a physical text that you can see exactly what's crossed out and things of that sort. And so I realized in this case, this one person, it was very valuable to do that. But let me get back to your book about something that you mentioned in Covert Capital. You said that many people involved in the covert operation go into exile, taking their stories with them. So they might be working in the CIA, but then they leave and they go somewhere else. So their stories, you maybe are in France or somewhere, or Italy, wherever they retire, they seem like they take their stories. Mm-hmm. How does that affect you in terms of your research, where you go and look up and somebody that they're just not in the area anymore and they took all their documents abroad?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of oddly covert, top secretive CIA agents and officers love writing memoirs and talking and giving interviews. It's like the repression of their secret life.
People say that. That's the same thing about mafia people. They just love to talk.
Urge to speak. So there's a lot of that. I mean, families donate archives often. One of my favorite places to work is, like, local historical societies, because they often, in a less barricaded way, have incredible transnational, international stuff that somebody's granddaughter was like, hey, you know, do you want this stuff? And it turns out that their grandparent was a major figure of some sort. But then also, you know, like I was saying before, I also really think it's important for us to think of, like, the rights and belonging of so many immigrant communities in Northern Virginia, Vietnamese American, Korean American, Iranian American, El Salvadoran, other Central American people, Ethiopian, as, like, having a testifying and testimonial relationship to stretched out communities of U.S. power and making their own archives of these relationships that are really complex, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to think about how, like, while these are often imperial communities, that they're still structured by racial hierarchy and different forms of access and safety. So while many white, you know, agents from South Vietnam can come back and just code as, like, suburbanites who are there for a long time, their best friends and their intimates and colleagues who in Vietnam were crucial to the American project come back and have to deal with racism and exile and citizenship issues. So how are those communities broken and violated? And how do we think about that? I think is a really major thing going forward.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you're going forward, Andrew Freeman, because your book is extremely important. You know, as soon as I got it, you know, but you know, when you gave me a copy, I said, "Oh, we got to do a program," because I felt this is valuable information. Anybody who's, you know, driving, you know, on the corridor right now is like probably pulled over and said, "Okay, I don't want to continue. I'm scared of what Andrew Freeman has been talking about. There are ghosts around here somewhere." But I want to thank you very much in terms of, you know, what the information you've given us, especially in terms of local history. So my guest today has been Andrew Freeman. He's the John R. Coleman Associate Professor of History at Haverford College. And we've been talking about his book, Covert Capital, Landscapes of Denial and the Making of U.S. Empire in the Suburbs of Northern Virginia. The show's on the margin. My name's Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW programmers Miyuki Williams, Robin Holden, Craig Williams, Jim Byers, Verna Avery Brown, James Funk, Captain Fly, Tom Cole, Bill Wax, Kim Bay, Millie Ware, Joni Eisenberg, Arthur McLeod, Donald Temple, Bill Starr, Lona Elias, Ron Pinchback, David Whetstone, DJ Abby, DJ Divine, and Willard Jenkins will celebrate you at Washington's premier jazz club, Tacoma Station, 6914 4th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. This is a musical tribute on Sunday, May 26, from 5 until 9 p.m.
This event features internationally renowned bassist Michael Bowie, Hope Udobie on keyboards, Charles Wilson drums, Grace J and Sing Steph on vocals, and others.
Please come and join your favorite programmers for some great jazz, food, cocktails, and a little dancing for a Sunday jazz happy hour you will never forget.
The event happens at the Tacoma Station Jazz Club, 6914 4th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., a musical fundraising tribute, Sunday, May 26, 5 until 9 p.m. The tickets are $50, and there are only 100 tickets for this VIP event. Secure your tickets to the Jazz Happy Hour.
Tickets are available at Eventbrite. When in Eventbrite, please search WPFW Tacoma Station. We're looking forward to celebrating you on Sunday, May 26th from 5 until 9 p.m. at Tacoma Station.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar. But two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
The DC Music Census is now live. Led by the DC Commission on the Arts and Humanities, the DC Music Census is an initiative that collects data from music industry professionals about the DMV's music economy, allowing the district to make informed decisions in supporting the music ecosystem. The census is anonymous and designed for anyone working within the music industry. Members of the music community may take the census by visiting dcmusiccensus.org. That's dcmusiccensus.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
It takes volunteers to keep jazz and justice alive in the DMV. And WPFW is in need of listeners' participation in our spring membership drive by answering phones and entering data from May 12th through the 25th. It's a fun opportunity to meet WPFW's staff and WPFW's host of your favorite shows.
Are you a student in need of community service or a member of an organization that loves volunteering?